So, good morning, everybody. Before we continue with the MR pre-processing algorithms we want to consider, let's briefly summarize the topics that we have considered so far. The mind map at the beginning. We started to look into the field of pre-processing in medical imaging. And if you think about an imaging system, how that is built today, a medical imaging system, you have your sensor, you have your computer, you have your patient, and then you have your monitor. And pre-processing is, in our context, is nothing else but the algorithms that are performed on the sensor data in between the sensor and the monitor. So that's pre-processing. In other words, before we see the image the first time on the monitor, algorithms are applied, and these are the pre-processing algorithms. And dependent on the principle we are using for visualizing the inner of the human body, we get artifacts into the acquired images. And the question is, how can we remove artifacts from the way of the signal from the sensor to the monitor? And so far, we have just considered one modality. That's X-ray. And we have seen that there are three technologies out there to convert X-ray energy into images. And these three techniques are films, analog technique that is no longer used in modern systems. Then we have seen image intensifiers, where a vacuum tube is used with an electron optics to amplify the signal. It's also old technology, but still available in the hospitals. So image intensifiers. Image intensifiers. And then we have flat panel detectors, and the abbreviation is FD, so flat panel detectors. This here is an analog technique, no algorithms applied. So from our perspective, it's not that much interesting. The image intensifiers, they imply now artifacts. Which types of artifacts did we consider? Artifacts. So here we have seen that we get distortions into the images. The distortion is implied by the fact that we have an electron optics for amplifying the signal. Electrons moving in the Earth magnetic field are deviated. These deviations cause distortions in images, and the order of magnitude we observe is that distortion of 20 pixels at the boundary of the image is something that is happening. Yeah? So 20 pixels offset is something that can happen, and that does not make us happy. And for image distortion, we have learned about compensation or undistortion algorithms. And in this context, we talked about calibration. So we have seen calibration patterns where by the manufacturing process, we exactly know where the points have to be. Then we acquire images. We see the points are distorted, the mutual distances of points are changed, and we use this type of information to estimate the distortion mapping. And the distortion mapping is estimated by using, in our case, it was a parametric function and polynomial mapping, and we estimated the whole thing by using a least square estimator. A very important technique, and we will also see today or maybe on Thursday another application of a least square estimator. Very important technique. And then the second one was associated, the second artifact we have considered was associated with FDs. And FD detectors have the nice property that they are not affected by magnetic fields. But the manufacturing process leads to defect pixels, and somehow we have to come up with sandpaper algorithms to smear the image information in a way that we don't see that there are defects on the detector. Yeah? So the second class was defect pixel interpolation. And in this context, we have seen two different approaches. And let me specify this in more detail, the defect pixel interpolation. So we have seen that there are two different methods. One is working in the spatial domain. Spatial domain methods that use the image signal as it is acquired, and then you do interpolation. We talked about linear interpolation or bilinear interpolation if you consider this in 2D. Yeah, remember just the picture where you have, let's say, two points, and you assume that the two points are linked by a linear function or an affine function, and you want to have the function value at this point. You just do interpolation, estimate the linear function, and then you just take the function value at this particular point here to get an estimate for the unknown value. And the second method that I consider more powerful, that can even deal with noise, are methods that work in the frequency domain. And we have seen two methods. One method is using a high-pass filtering technique by just cutting out the high frequency, low-pass technique by just cutting out the high frequencies. The high frequencies come in that you have a complete drop of the signal at those points where the defect pixels are. So this leads to high frequencies in the signal, and these high frequencies violate the Nyquist-Shannon sampling theorem. That was the idea. And the other one was an idea where we just look at two pairs within the spectrum or within the Fourier transform, and we consider the defect generation as a multiplication of an ideal image with a defect mask, and this multiplication, pixel-wise multiplication with a defect mask, can be rewritten in terms of a convolution in the frequency domain, and then we did an unconvolution algorithm using the idea of just considering pairs of the Fourier transform. And the pairs we have selected were given by the fact that the Fourier transform exhibits a certain property if you transform real valued signals. And the property that we have used is that the Fourier transform at a particular point X is the conjugate complex Fourier transform at the point n minus X if you have a real valued signal that you have transformed. Yeah, we have also shown this property of the Fourier transform. Okay, and the next thing we are considering, and that's the chapter we started to dig into on Thursday, is MRI. Magnetic resonance imaging, and the artifacts that we have to deal with in MRI. Okay, questions so far? So if you have to answer the question at the course evaluation, is there a storyline supporting the lecture, you have to say yes, because there is a story. Yeah, this is the story. This is the story. And for those of you who have never attended a lecture of mine and an oral exam, these mind maps are also a good tool for guiding you through an oral exam. I first check the broad overview of the lecture, whether you have understood what the lecture was about, and then we go into details. And at this point, for instance, we are ready to go for formulas, yeah, and algorithms. And depending on how much I like you, I will go deeper and deeper and deeper. I'm always saying in the oral exam, it's not my task to find out what you know. I'm a computer scientist. I'm a pattern recognition guy. I'm interested in the boundary between the region of your knowledge and the region of your unknowledge. And I have to check where you are at, yeah? And that's where I try to find where you are positioned. Good. So a brief refresher course on MRI. We already have discussed last week the donut-shaped structure of the MR scanners. There are also systems out there with open magnets, but the most common architecture that is used nowadays is this donut-shaped type of MR scanner. And these scanners, from a certain distance, they look pretty much the same like CT scanners. So we as experts, of course, can distinguish the systems, but without image processing background, medical imaging background, people cannot nicely differentiate between the different modalities. So what are the physical and mathematical ingredients that we are using? We have already seen that we use magnetic properties of atoms here, so some kind of quantum physics effects. We use homogeneous magnetic fields to have an impact on these mini magnets, let me say it this way. Then a resonance phenomenon of these mini magnets are used. We use Fourier methods for reconstruction. Oh my God, again, Fourier transform. Yes, that's what signal processing is all about. And we will talk about image enhancement algorithms that will reduce artifacts. And for the following two lectures, for us, the bias field correction is what we consider in more detail. What are the components of an MR scanner? First of all, we have this huge magnet here that applies field strengths of 1.5 Tesla, 3 Tesla. That's used in hospitals nowadays. In experimental environments, we go up to 9 Tesla, 7, 9 Tesla. So very strong magnetic fields. And you can browse YouTube and check for MR accidents, where you can see the cleaning stuff with the vacuum cleaner with some metal parts in it, yeah, being just blown against the magnets, because the magnet fields are so strong. The magnet fields are so strong. Also, your credit cards or things like that can be destroyed. And these magnets are so strong that also the tools that doctors are using in their environment cannot be magnetic. Yeah, even your belt or your belt should not be magnetic, because otherwise you have real strong forces on these metal parts. And that's also a reason why MR scanners are not that much used in surgery environments, because all your knives and all your tools have to be built in a way that they are not affected by the magnet. We have here in the neurosurgery department one of the first surgery rooms where an MR scanner is used during surgeries, but these environments are very expensive, because you have to have very, very special tools for it. So you need a main magnet, then you need a magnetic field gradient system. That means that the gradient, the magnetic field, the magnetic field in space should be different at each spatial point. So you have a magnetic field, And at each point in space, you have a different type of field strength. That's what we want to generate. And the reason for that is that we will later on use the magnetic field space encoding for identifying each and every pixel in space. Yeah? We want to know where one pixel is in space or one voxel is in space. So we have a gradient field. And then we have a radio frequency system where we just apply high frequency impulses. And again, we have an imaging system that is sitting in a computer next to the sensoric device. Yeah? So we acquire the signals, and then the signals are transformed into images. The main magnet is required to generate a strong uniform static magnetic field, and there are different techniques to generate the magnetic field. So if you have a magnetic field that is below 0.3 Tesla, it's not that strong. It's strong, but it's not that strong for generating brilliant medical images. You can use a permanent magnet. So if it goes above 0.3 Tesla, you cannot find proper permanent magnets that have this field strength. So these MR systems usually do not have permanent magnets. Then you have electromagnets, resistive magnets. They support fields up to 1.5 Tesla. So if you have a clinical system, 1.5 Tesla, that was standard a few years ago. Nowadays, there's smaller systems operate with 1.5 Tesla. So they have a resistive magnet. And then if you have higher field strengths, then you need superconducting material. Yeah, you need superconducting material for generating the magnetic fields, and then you need special cooling techniques, and then it starts to become real expensive. Yeah, if you attend the setup of a magnet of a modern MR scanner, there is also a huge tank for helium and for cooling the system, and you have to fill up the magnet with this type of cooling substances, and this is a very, very intense procedure. And if we talk about weight, for instance, if you use a standard magneton scanner, the magnet is already 6.5 tons. 6.5 tons. So if you get a new MR scanner, it's usually a big event to bring the magnet into the hospital. And you can also think about the requirements for the statics of the hospital building. And you also have to make sure that the magnet is properly shielded, and things like that. And again, a story, I mean, if you look at the older videos, I'd always tell this story, but this is a very nice story. So those of you who have already heard it, just ignore it. The others, listen. When I was working for industry, I was building the first generations for 3D reconstruction using X-ray devices. And we installed a system. And these systems, they always had a software component for distortion correction, because the systems I was building at the end of the 90s, they have all used image intensifier techniques. And if you want to do 3D reconstruction, you have to make sure that straight lines are mapped to straight lines on the image, on the image plane. And if you have distortions, the straight lines are curved, and then you get just nonsense 3D reconstruction. So we built distortion correction software, we built a reconstruction software, we have used image intensifier techniques and put it to the hospital, and it was properly working at most places in the world. And in one hospital, the doctor called us and said, you have installed the system, but it seems that there is a problem with the system, because sometimes the images are just unusable for us. And the reason for the extreme bad image quality that was observed was that one level below the X-ray machine, there was an MR scanner. And when they switched on the magnet of the MR scanner, the image intensifier tube was affected by the strong magnet, and the images were distorted in a way that these couldn't be corrected properly, and that caused trouble. Yes?
So isn't the big magnet, so the 3 Tesla magnet, it's always on, isn't it?
So it's always on,
yeah. Off, so yeah. Shouldn't the distortion happen on every image?
Yeah, but it was affected when they operated the MR. So when they run patients, they change the magnet field, yeah, adjusting something. I don't know the details. But at this point, we had a huge problem with the induced magnetic field, and it was very interesting to find that out. Yeah, so these interactions. So a shielding can solve this type of problem. Yeah, and if you switch off the magnet, superconducting magnet, and it's really expensive to bring it up again. It's really an expensive procedure that takes time. And then the field gradient, and I already gave you an intuition for that. You want to have different gradient strengths in the spatial domain to make sure that different gradients are applied to the mini magnets, and this will allow you some kind of spatial encoding to find later on which part of the human body, which voxel was addressed by the whole system. Yeah, so to distinguish between the nuclei, that means the spatial distinction, the idea to have a unique magnetic field with each nuclei, and this can be used by using a gradient field. Yeah. A gradient is always some, in terms of analysis, a gradient is a vector that tells you how things change from one point to the other, yeah, or how much the surface changes on a 2D function surface. So here also we have changes, gradients in the magnetic field. And the interesting thing is also that these gradients, they can be generated by software. So if, for instance, the patient is moving, you can also adjust the gradient, that the gradient field is adjusted to the motion of the patient, that your spatial encoding is basically telling you where one point is moving towards, and that's a very, very interesting stuff. And I also have to say, there is no other imaging modality nowadays that has so many programming interfaces like MR scanners. The MR scanners have so many degrees of freedom. You can use different RF coils, you can use different gradient fields, you can run different protocols. So people all over the world are doing a lot of experiments using these degrees of freedoms, and they generate different protocols for acquiring certain parts of the human body. So there is a lot of research in that field, and I would bet that the most research is actually done outside of industry in MR imaging, if you think about the activities in medical imaging. So if you go into the MR field with research, this is a very, very competitive field. There are many, many people out there, and it's very, very hard to be or to come up with unique ideas that nobody has thought of before. The gradient system, so the magnetic field gradient system is required to generate magnetic fields that are well defined and controlled, and they imply spatial inhomogeneity in the magnetic field. So you have different magnetic strength at different points, and the gradient field is needed for signal localization in space. Yeah, and the rise time to ramp up a gradient decides on the quality of the gradient that you're using. And today you can change the gradient flow within 1 millisecond, which is a number that is quite impressive. Then you have the radio frequency system. These are those caves that you use when you put the patient into the scanner. Who had already an MR scan in the audience here? Is there anybody? Okay. So you also had the radio frequency device?
I work as a radiology assistant.
Oh, okay. So how many different RF caves did you have?
At body coils, uh-huh. one head coil, one a loop coil,
uh-huh.
and one for the knee,
uh-huh.
and one small coil for small joints like the first G or
Uh-huh. Okay, and did you decide on the coil, or did the radiologist tell you which coil to use?
No, there was a coil
standard.
Management.
Okay.
It was standard.
Uh huh.
Yes.
Okay. Mm-hmm. And this here is a head coil for head images, and here you see a coil for the abdominal chest part. Yeah. And also, coil design is part of research nowadays still. How to build proper coils or radio frequency RF systems that can be used for image acquisition. And what is the purpose of that? We have two different types. First of all, transmission and receiver coils. The receiver coils are used to acquire the signal that is sent out by the magnets. So if you apply an external magnetic field to your small atomic magnets, let me say it this way, they get aligned. Yeah? So if you think about a compass and a needle, and if you have a magnet from outside, the needle rotates into this direction. And if you have these charges rotating and moving within a magnetic field, they induce electricity, and this can be measured and can be transformed into an image signal. So the transmitter coil generates, first of all, a rotating magnetic field to excite the spin system. So it's just an impulse that changes things in these mini magnets. And the receiver coil that basically receives the magnetic changes and turns it or transforms it into electric signals that can be visualized in terms of an intensity value in the final image. So these coils have a very important role. And what do we have to keep in mind if we talk about nuclear magnets? You just have to keep this type of picture in mind. So you have your object. Let me say it this way. Now let me take this one. You have your object, and you have a spin. So the atom is rotating. And then the axis is not aligned, the rotation axis is not aligned with this axis here. So it's also, first of all, rotating this way and then rotating around the axis. This is called precession. Yeah? Like you know it, and I say it in German because I don't know the English words. Es ist wie so ein Kreisel, der dann, wenn er schief angedreht wird, eine Achse eiert. Yeah? Yeah? So if you have... What is Kreisel in English? I didn't look that up. It's a Kreisel. Yeah, so these devices, you know, when you have been a kid, yeah, you just rotated it and then it was spinning around, and at some point it was not properly spinning, but it was a little bit, you know, off axis, and then it started to wobble around and another axis. Yeah, okay? Spinner? Spinner. Okay, you just looked it up. Good to have Google. Okay. Or you prepared for the lecture yesterday in the evening. Hey. Huh? You looked it up. Spinner. Okay. Different associations with this type of word. But, okay. And what you have to do with that, so Pauli, that's a physicist, he found out a basic property, that's the spin of the nuclei, and the spin angular moment is denoted by J. So there is a moment that is implied by these mini magnets, and the nuclear spin, with the nuclear spin, a microscopic, so a very small magnetic field, is associated, because nuclei, like protons, they carry electrical charges and they rotate it around the own axis if the spin is non-zero. And then there is the important formula here, but these things I won't, these things are not required for the oral exam, at least in my oral exam. So the spin angular moment and the magnetic moment, they are collinear, and here One constant is very important. That's the so-called gyromagnetic ratio. Yeah? So the angular moment and the magnetic moment are just here in a linear correlation. And then you can also compute the magnitude of the magnetic moment by using quantum physics. Forget about these formulas. Do not learn these formulas. Basically, you can compute this based on half integer numbers. So this L here, or capital I, are half integer numbers. And here you have the Planck's constant, you have the gyrometric constant, and you can compute the magnetic moment implied by this small magnet. And for us, the precision frequency is very important. So that's the frequency the spinner is rotating off axis. Yeah. That's very important. And the precision frequency is given by this formula. It's the gamma, the gyrometric constant, multiplied with the strength of the external field that is applied. So if you have these small nuclei, yeah, and they have this type of off-axis rotation, and you apply a certain magnetic field from outside with certain strength, dependent on the material you have, this frequency is adjusting to this formula here. Okay, so you can affect the frequency of the spinner, the off-axis frequency that is called Larmor frequency, by an external magnetic field. Okay? And then you can visualize different effects. You can measure the spin density. You can measure different relaxation times. So if you apply, for instance, an external magnetic impulse, these magnets, they are misaligned, and then they come back and being aligned again in the magnetic field, and the time it takes for this alignment can be measured by using the spin-spin relaxation time. You can also measure molecular motion, so you can measure the behavior of the whole system over time, and if things are moving within nerve fibers, for instance, you can visualize this by using magnetic properties. So once again, what do we have to keep in mind when we think about the human body? There are all these little compasses, yeah, these little magnets. Then we apply a magnet from outside, and then these magnets get aligned. Yeah, they get aligned, and they have a so-called Larmor frequency that depends on the external magnetic field. And then you can imply, for instance, impulses from the outside, so they get misaligned again, and then they come back within the homogeneous magnet. And all these magnets, once they change something, they induce electricity, and this can be measured and turned into imaging signals, or image signals, sorry. That was a very poor man's explanation of MR physics. Yeah, poor man's explanation. There are whole lectures on this. For us, it's important to understand there are strong magnets, and you generate images, and we get a few inhomogeneities in that we will consider from an algorithmic point of view. What are the pros and cons of MRI? First of all, it's good for the patient because ionizing rays are applied. We have a high spatial resolution, so we can get to 50 microns nowadays. We have an excellent contrast resolution. That's also why MR is mostly used for brain imaging, because your contrast resolution is way higher. We know image quality is determined by three components: noise, spatial resolution, and contrast resolution. So how much is the image corrupted by noise? What are the structures that I can still see in the image? That's spatial resolution. Yeah. What is the minimum size that I still can see? And the third one is contrast. So which tissue classes can I separate from each other? Can I, for instance, separate water from blood? In X-ray, you will never ever see difference between blood and water in the human body. Yeah? So with MR, you have an excellent contrast resolution. You have rich information about the anatomical structure, given by the fact that you have a high contrast resolution. You can also do quantitative analysis, but compared to CT, MR has one crucial disadvantage, and that is that certain materials do not lead to one and the same intensity value. So if you look at water and the final intensity value in the MR image, it's no direct mapping from the intensity value to the material that you have seen in the object. Yeah? You always, the doctor looks at it and sees it in the context and can assign to certain intensities certain materials, but there is no one-to-one mapping between intensities and material values compared to CT, where you have a better assignment of this. You can use it before an operation, within an operation, and in the interventional suite, with the disadvantages you know already know in terms of magnetic of the tools we are using. You can use it also for functional imaging, as we will see later on. And you can also inject contrast agent with certain property in the human body, in the blood, and if the magnetic properties are different of the nuclei you induce, then you can visualize different things using contrast agents. And nowadays, these magnetic scanners are also combined with other MR scanners are also combined with other scanners like PET scanners. The most recent research system is the MR PET scanner. We have one here in Erlangen where you can simultaneously acquire MR images and PET images. And from an engineering point of view, these systems are very demanding due to the strong magnetic fields that are always associated with a magnetic resonance imaging system. So these are the pros, a few cons. It's very expensive. MR scanners are very expensive. Also, the maintenance is very expensive of the MR scanners. You know the place on Earth where you have the highest density of MR scanners? Yes, okay. Inhomogeneities are caused by the radio frequency coils. So you get, it's Erlangen, the highest density. Always tell people what's so positive. Don't talk about the downside. We don't have an airport. Yeah. We don't have an international train station. We have a lot of problems too. Good. Then intensity inhomogeneities, they produce spatial changes in tissue statistics. That means that in an MR image, the intensity value of water can be 5, but it can also be 1,000. Yeah? Due to these inhomogeneities. So different intensities at different points in the image may also characterize the same molecular structure. We have inhomogeneities that can also change with different acquisition parameters, so dependent on the setup you are using, and from patient to patient, and from slice to slice, if you acquire a 3D image, things can vary. We will see examples in a few seconds. And it's dangerous to use these magnets, because if you use ferromagnetic objects close to the magnet, then accidents can happen. And I put here a link to a page where you can see a few nice videos where they fight, you know, with the vacuum cleaner sitting on the magnet or things like that. Yeah. Did you also had an accident in your lab?
Yes, we had an MRI compatible Rollstuhl.
Okay, wheelchair?
Wheelchair, yes. And
it was MR compatible?
MR compatible, yes. It was said so. And
so they sold it to you for a lot of money?
Yes. And when and
good trick.
When I was about to go to the patient, the whole wheelchair was turning around and was hanging in the MRI. And it could be replaced because we used manpower of three people, and that was okay. And it was so that the wheelchair was not magnetic, but the skews.
Ah, the screw.
The screws.
Okay.
Very magnetic. So
okay.
It was, yes, engineering masterpiece.
Did you videotape it and put it on the web?
Oh, no.
Okay, the flying wheelchair. Was a patient sitting on it, or you were
no, just on the way
to get the patient?
I was.
And what did the company tell you when you talked to them later on? Who sold?
And they
the guys who sold the wheelchair?
They were saying, yes, I had to ask if I can use the wheelchair really in the MRI. So, but they told me it is usable for MRI.
I see. It's like
so nothing should have happened if the patient weight was on the wheelchair.
And did you try?
No.
I mean, think about if you need three people to get it off the magnet. You need.
But you have a little space behind the magnet.
Nice story. Did you order also other wheelchairs from that company? No. Still existing, the company?
Yes.
Okay. Good. Interesting. And now we will talk about bias and gain fields, and I'll show you a few examples. Yeah, you can read the text at home. I'm here to give you the ideas. Look at this. This is the left one. This is the image you measure. Yeah. So you see two well-separated intensity classes, but you also see some inhomogeneity, so the image overall is getting brighter, darker. So you have an overlay of the ideal image with this type of low-frequency inhomogeneity image. Yeah? This can be a multiplicative model where you multiply the two, or an additive model where you add just the intensities pixel-wise up. And then you get this type of image. And that's actually what happens in MR. You have these slowly changing intensity variations due to the magnetic field or to the RF field inhomogeneities. And you see images that are brighter at certain parts and darker at certain parts. So one and the same tissue class can have higher values and smaller intensity values within the image. It can also even happen that these two tissue classes that you see in the ideal image, they have the same intensity value here and here, but show different tissue classes. Yeah, so dependent on the inhomogeneity, you can select two intensity points that belong to different tissues, but show the same intensity value. Yeah, not at the same in the same area of the image, but at different points where the image inhomogeneity happened. So that's a problem, and that's a serious problem actually for post-processing. If you look at these images, and that's a real MR image, you see something like that. It's bright here. What do I see actually? What is this?
Brain.
That's a brain. Yeah, that's a brain. One slice through the brain, and then you see it's getting darker and darker and darker from image row to image row to image row. And this is the normalized image where we have eliminated this intensity ramp that is in the image. And our task in the following will be to design algorithms that are able to compute out of one image like this, these two images. And this one is then provided to the doctor. There is no MR scanner out there that is not doing this type of homogenization of the images before they are shown on the monitor. Yeah? And if you want to do post-processing with MR images, you have to do this type of correction. If you do image registration later on or image segmentation without doing the intensity correction, you have to fight with a lot of problems. For instance, here, I mean, don't read the text. What do you see here? What is it? If I give you just the image showing here on the left, what would you say? What do you see? It's a checkerboard. Yeah? Schachbrett, checkerboard. Yeah, but there are bright spots and darker spots, but overall I see the rectangular substructure of the components of the checkerboard. Yeah? And if I ask you, can you draw the contour lines of different materials, I'm pretty much sure that the domain knowledge you have leads you to the idea that you have to draw a line here, a line here, a line here, and a line here to do a proper image segmentation. If you just do image segmentation using standard methods that we know from image processing, saying we have a change in tissue classes, if the intensities change a lot, if the intensities change a lot, that means the gradient is high, so we compute for each pixel the gradient within the image and look at the magnitude of the gradient, and if the magnitude is above a threshold, we say there is an edge. Yeah, and if you do things like that, you get boundaries like this here without any domain knowledge and without any compensation of these inhomogeneities that you see over here, you will get this type of segmentation. And you can imagine what that means if you do an automatic segmentation of a tumor for metastasis or some lesion, and you have this type of artifacts sitting on the MR image, and then you come up with a contour where the doctor looks at it and says, I mean, what's that? Yeah? That's unusable for me. What we want to have is an automatic segmentation like this. And this is actually computed out of this image by using a image in homogeneity correction algorithm before doing the segmentation. Another example is, here you see an MR image of the human skull and also the shoulder. It's just a section through the human body here. And you might assume if you want to see certain parts in or want to emphasize certain parts in the image, you do a thresholding, saying if the intensity value is above a certain threshold, I put the intensity value to 255. And if it's below a threshold, it's assigned to zero. We call this image binarization. And if you use the same threshold for two images with two different patients, you see here, the threshold leads to a nice type of segmentation of the brain. At least you see the substructures a little bit. If you look at the other one and the same threshold, you get this type of binarized image, and this is something you cannot use. Huh? So you have to have what you would like to have is a method that maps all the intensities to proper values that one threshold can be used, for instance, to find brain tissue or water molecules or things like that. You can do this in CT, but not in MR. And without a normalization and homogenization, you won't be able to apply thresholding techniques for image segmentation, as these examples here show. And now let's think about the mathematical modeling of inhomogeneities. And that's what we have to consider, like we did it with the artifacts with a flat panel, where we said the original image is just multiplied with a defect image. We can come up with a similar model for MR inhomogeneity modeling. And there are basically two different types of models. One is saying the inhomogeneity is additive, so we add up the variations of the intensities to the original ideal image. And the other one is that we have a multiplicative model. And both models are used in image processing, and I'll just describe them. Before, let's think about how we can just out of the blue, let's think about how can we potentially find these low frequency intensity variations. For instance, if you have an original image like this, where this is one image line where you have this type of contour of the intensity value. So you have here your x and here your intensity value. Yeah? So I go through an image, I look at one line, and I, let's say I have I have here three vertical lines like this. So the intensity value is down, then it goes up, goes down, goes up, goes down, goes up, goes down. Okay? So that's the intensity profile that we see here at one line. And now think about the following. We have an intensity ramp that is very bright here, and it's getting darker over there. So it's starting with a zero intensity, and then it's homogeneously ramping up to a certain value. How does that affect this line here, this line profile? What happens? It will look like this. Yeah? So you just add up these two, and then it will be brought up here. Okay, it will be brought up here. And how would you, for instance, estimate this increase here? For instance, you can fit in a polynomial and then subtract the polynomial from this intensity value. So what you can do is, for instance, you can fit in here a regression line and then subtract the values of the regression line from the original value. And that's actually what we will do later on with so-called hypersurface models. We will fit in to the surface, image surface implied by the intensity value, some polynomials, and then we will use the polynomials to normalize the intensity. Then we can also say the inhomogeneities are low frequency changes. So we can use low frequency models to remove the inhomogeneities. We will see different approaches that will do that. So the image intensity homogeneity can be generated by using images that are low pass filtered. We will also see a few examples of that. And the third one, the third class of algorithms we want to look at are statistical methods. And I like statistics very much. That might be an indicator for the probability which type of method will be most probably be asked within the oral exam. Yeah? So these are the three classes we are going to consider. And now the models that we apply, the heterogeneous image that we measure can be assumed to be affected by a so-called gain field. Gain field, and the gain field is applied multiplicatively. So pixel-wise, we multiply with a gain field with a smoothly changing intensity ramp in this example, and then we add some noise on the pixel values. Yeah, that's one model that we can use. And what you can do is, for instance, use a Gaussian filter to eliminate for the noise here if it's assumed to be Gaussian, and then try to find out how you can factorize the measured intensity value in a way that you get the pixel value of the ideal image and the pixel value of the so-called gain field. Yeah? So correction methods later on will mostly be applied to this product here, and the noise should be eliminated before. Another example, using a bias field, what you can do is you can also use a homomorphism, that's how mathematicians call it, and replace the multiplication by a summation using the logarithmic domain of the image. Yeah? So if you compute the logarithm of the intensities, then you can separate the ideal pixel value from the bias field value by just here a summation. Yeah, it's they are combined by a summation. Okay, that's a trick that we quite often apply. For instance, in statistics, if you multiply probabilities, you apply the logarithm, and then you get the sum of logarithmic probabilities. And if you know about the bias field or gain field, how can you correct for it? If you use the original multiplicative model, you just divide by the bias field. Yeah, you have to be careful. The division by zero is a problem, but basically you have to divide. And if you use the bias field correction approach in the logarithmic domain, you just subtract the logarithms. These are formulas or formalisms that you are aware of. And now, which model should be applied? It's up to your taste. Early models for image inhomogeneity have used pure additive models, but you can say that additive models are rarely observed in MRI, so you have to use the multiplicative model or the logarithmic model, where you transform the multiplication into an addition. But original or pure additive models are not used nowadays. Multiplicative models are commonly accepted now in the community, and you have to be careful if you use log models with Gaussian noise, then things are not that properly modeling the real world if you look at the logarithmic values. Of course, if you have Gaussian noise in the original domain and if you apply the logarithm, the final noise will not be a Gaussian type of noise structure. So that's something you have to keep in mind, that Gaussian filtering is not properly working. Okay, so what we have to think about is the multiplicative model. So Gij is the ideal image plus the gain field plus some noise at this point. Quite often this noise is ignored, or by a filtering operation this is reduced to a certain extent. Then we can use just the multiplicative model Bij, and this is equivalent to the logarithmic model, where we use Fij plus log Bij. And the idea of using Fij to be Gij to be Fij plus Bij, that's something that we are not considering, because these effects are not properly modeled in, or not showing up in MRI. So the additive model is not something that we see quite often. We use the multiplicative model or the log additive model for bias correction. Okay? Now let me just go back to this example here. So we have here our intensity image, our slice through the human brain. We see here our intensity ramp, and we see here the corrected image. What can we conclude if we look at this image? We can say the intensity changes in the local environment, in the local neighborhood of a selected pixel, will be very small. Yeah, the intensity changes will be very small. It's smoothly going down. It's a smooth function. So this function will have low frequencies. This function will have low frequencies. And the idea that people now apply to remove this low frequency ramp is you do a high pass filter and you say these small frequencies that are induced by the inhomogeneity are eliminated by just having a filter that cancels out the low frequencies and passes through the high frequencies. That's the idea. Yeah? And low pass and high pass filters can be done also in the frequency or implemented in the frequency domain. And there are powerful high pass filters implemented to eliminate these. So these low frequency bias fields. So our task now is, any questions? Ask me. I'm paid for it. He's not paid for it. I mean, this guy is buying wheelchairs. you know, MR. You said we we bought it. This guy buys wheelchairs being MR compatible, where the frame is MR compatible, but not the screws. And do you trust his answers?
Maybe.
Maybe. Okay. As long as it does not come to screws, yes, that's a good comment. Now we can agree on. I'm paid. I get paid for answering questions. So you should ask me. He's not paid.
Okay.
Yeah. That does not imply that I'm well paid. Yeah. He just says I'm paid. I'm not well paid, but I'm paid. But I also get the money if you don't ask questions. So. That's the nice thing being a professor. You know, you get your money independent of whether you are well performing in research or whether you are an excellent teacher or not. You just get your money. That's nice. That's nice. I appreciate that very much. So we want to design a high pass filter that eliminates these low pass frequencies. And an idea that we have implemented in early days is very simple. Let me just tell you what we did. I mean, how would you compute without knowing too much about signal processing, image processing? How would you compute out of that image, this image? Any ideas?
Gaussian smoothing, very, very strong Gaussian smoothing to get the bias field and then the division.
Okay, that is good. What does it mean, Gaussian filter that does a very strong smoothing? That, for instance, what you can use is a huge Gaussian kernel. Or if you think about mean filtering, yeah, that means you replace one pixel by the mean of the value in the environment. And if you increase the window where you compute the mean of, let's say to size 101 by 101, you get a very, very rough structure at the end of the day. And with this type of low-pass filtering using a 101 by 101 window, 101 by 101 window, you will get finally this type of image. And then you subtract it from this one, or you correct for it using one of these models. Then you get the original one. And this, of course, can also be done in the frequency domain. What does it mean, low frequencies? That means you need to cut off the Fourier coefficients that are in charge of the low frequencies. Yeah. So if you look at your Fourier transformed image, a filter, if this here is your Fourier transform, and if you cut out, for instance, these Fourier coefficients and you do a back transform, then you have a high pass filter. You can easily, yes?
But are we really doing this? Because when I learned about signal processing, I was told this is absolutely horrible because then you will fold in the sync function. So
yeah.
Last time we talked about a similar method, and I was wondering how do we really do this? Because there should be some sync artifacts. So because I tried it out in Mathe,
mm-hmm.
and it was horrible.
It's horrible.
It's folding in the sync function, and one will see infinity by sync. So this.
Yeah, I mean the design of high and low pass filters is usually not that simplistic, but the basic idea is reflected by this type of structure. Yeah, and the approach I have described with the low pass filter using the large kernels is pretty much working in practice.
Okay. Yeah, of course, this one will not have the problem because it's smooth.
Yeah.
If I just cut it to zero,
then you get artifacts in. That's right. But you should try these things with MATLAB and play around with it. So that's filter design is a very, very tough field. There are whole lectures on on that, that's right. So one example that we have used for image inhomogeneity was making use of the convolution theorem of the Fourier transform. So instead of just cutting out the low frequencies, as he was already mentioning, that's not a brilliant idea to do. You can think about how does the Fourier transform of the low-pass filter that you apply look like, and then you have the multiplication of the two kernels, and then you just divide by one of these kernels, yeah? Which is not the brutal type of cutting out the low frequencies. Yeah? And the kernel that we are looking at, for instance, is here defined by 1 minus beta e to the power of something. That's a low-pass filter that we can consider. You have a few parameters, you can vary these parameters, and the idea now is to say you unfold of the origin of the measured signal by using the low pass filter to get the original signal, and the original signal in the frequency domain can be converted into the spatial domain function by using the inverse Fourier transform. Yeah? And now you can play around with different deconvolution kernels here. But the idea is basically eliminate the high frequencies. And the other algorithm I wanna stress here a little bit, and that is heavily used in many applications in many MR scanners, is the homomorphic filtering. And the homomorphic filtering is also using the observation that we have to deal with artifacts of low frequencies, and we also assume that those high frequency components that are within the signal are due to anatomic variations. Yeah? So the elimination of inhomogeneities can be done by low-pass filtering, as I have mentioned with the mean filtering. And the unsharp masking idea is another one that is used. You take the measured signal and you apply the low-pass filter on the logarithmic signal, and then you do the subtraction of the low-pass filter signal, and you add here a mean value to make sure that you have a mean normalization. Yeah? So you do a correction, and you want to make sure that the final mean vector, the final mean intensity value, is in a certain range. So you add here a correction factor. Yeah? Because sometimes it happens that you bring the signal too much down, and you have to add a mi value such that certain properties of the final image are fulfilled. And mean normalization, and that's one important one, can be also done by homomorphic unsharp masking. And homomorphic unsharp masking is making use of the idea that the mean vector in certain sub-images should be the same. So if you have an image, like this, and you compute the mean value in this range and in this patch here, you expect that the mean value of the intensities should be pretty much the same. Yeah? If you remember the image that I have shown before with a skull, yeah, and we had this intensity ramp in here. Yeah, it's bright and getting darker. You know that the mean value here and the mean value here, they should be the same in principle in the brain, but in practice they are not the same. And what we do is some kind of mean normalization in these patches. And this is so-called the homomorphic submasking, and the homomorphic unsharp masking, sorry. And this is the formula we apply. This is the mean value of the whole image, and this is normalized by the mean value in the local environment of the currently considered intensity. or in the currently considered pixel. So we go into one pixel, or we visit one pixel, we take the mean of the whole image, we compute the mean in the local environment, let's say 51 by 51 window, and then we do this type of mean normalization, multiplying the measured signal with the ratio of the overall mean divided by the local mean. And if the local mean is identical to the overall mean, this ratio is 1, so nothing changes. Yeah? If it's smaller, so we do a scale up. If it's larger than the overall mean, we scale it down. Yeah? So you get an intuition how much this affects the overall image. Yeah? If you're in an area which is pretty much in the mean area of the whole intensity, nothing happens. If you're well below, you scale it up. If you're well above, you scale it down. Yeah? This is homomorphic unsharp masking that is very much or quite often applied. A few remarks on this. The image intensity homogeneity correction method using homomorphic unsharp masking relies on the basic assumption that the local mean is equal to the global mean. Yeah? That the local mean is equal to the global mean, which is for sure not true if you have full body scans. Yeah? You won't have the same mean value here like you have it down in the legs. So this is an assumption that is valid in certain areas of the human body, but not in whole body images. You have differences in local and global means that are just caused by the bias field in those areas where this initial assumption holds. The assumption holds only in the neighborhood used for computing the local mean, and the size of the neighborhood system is also to be has to be chosen carefully. Yeah, if you just use a 3x3 neighborhood, you will get a very noisy image. If your neighborhood is, let's say, 1K by 1K, you will gain nothing at all. So you have to find the best window size for your application, and that implies a lot of experimental efforts that have to be done. So, and now let's talk about polynomial surface fitting, and that's the idea I have started to figure out here, and this will be done by, again, least square fitting, let's say, build hours. So once again, let's look at this type of example. So let's assume this is not a straight line. Let's assume this is a polynomial. F of x is ax squared plus bx plus c. Yeah? Or if we think in 2D, f of xy is a of x squared plus b of y squared plus c of x y plus d of x plus e of y plus f, for instance. So we assume that the whole image is covered by a 2D function, and we have just a polynomial of degree 2, which means that we have, you know, a very small frequency representation of the surface. Yeah? So if you think about a function like this, once again, I sketch the 1D part x and f of x, and you fit in a quadratic function, you basically get something like this. And the idea is to fit in the quadratic function in a way that the distance of the points to the surface, the mean distance of the points to the surface of the regression function is minimized. So if we have to compute the coefficients, estimate A, B, C, D, E, and F, how can we compute the coefficients for a given image? how would you compute the coefficients? You want to write the...
I would.
It's videotaped. You want to do that? Okay.
I would do something like...
Min?
Minimizing the distance of my computed function.
Yeah.
Minus the measured function. And the computed function is depending on this coefficients.
Mm-hmm.
And the measured function, yeah, I get
by the image. Okay.
Mm-hmm. Then I use something like the Liebenberg-Marquardt or something like that.
Mm-hmm.
And minimize the distance mm-hmm. between these functions.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Thank you. So what you can do is you can estimate A, B. See, we always denote the estimates by an hat. E, A, B, C, D, E, F is the argument that minimizes the following function. And here, what's your name? Max has used the absolute value of the difference. We prefer the quadratic distance because then we can compute the gradient in closed form. What? What? Then we sum over all x, y. So we sum over all the pixels. We compute the measured intensity value. And then we say this has to be as similar as possible to the function here. And now we look for A, B, C, D, E, F such that this overall sum here is minimized. And the nice thing is that the parameters that we are looking for, they are linear in here. So if we have a quadratic function where one component is linear in A, B, C, D, E, F, then we have a function that is quadratic in the parameters we look for. And quadratic functions are very nice because there we can uniquely compute a maximum or minimum. So this function will be convex. And if you do Liebenberg-Marquardt, you can do that. That's an iterative method. Here we can just compute the gradient. We will get a linear function in A, B, C, D, E, F, and then we just use SVD to compute the zero crossings of the gradient. So we will even get a closed form solution for the parameters of A, B, C, and so on. Yeah, A, B, C, D, E. So we will end up with a closed form solution. So we compute the gradient of the sum and we set this to 0. And the gradient is computed with respect to A, B, C, and so on. So this is a 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, a six-dimensional gradient vector. And this here, the gradient is linear in the unknowns, then we can have a closed form solution for A, B, C, D, E, F. Yeah.
Explain the distance in the picture.
This is not, yeah.
But it is just in X, in Y direction.
Yeah, it's just here, this one. The correct answer, the correct question would have been, you explained it wrong. Can you do it right? Yeah. I mean, you can decide on the distance measure, but usually we just take the area here in between that we want to minimize. Yeah, and this is discretized by the sum. Yeah, and you can And this can be easily transformed into this type of setup. And if you are in higher dimensional spaces, the question is always, how do you define the distance between surfaces? And there are different ways to do that. For instance, the minimum distance that is required to be went through to hit a point at the surface, that's what I was drawing here. But the standard approach in this example is just using the area or the volume in 2D or 3D surface fitting. Is there anybody in the audience who would not be able to write down the details for this? So make sure that you know these things. Yeah? That you know these things. Yeah? Also how to transform this into matrix notation, and so that's something you really have to practice a little bit. You have to learn and to practice this a little bit. And once you have the polynomial, you just reduce the measurements by this. The measurements by this, and you get the corrected intensity values. Ah, wrong button. That was the wrong button. Oh, these computer scientists, yeah. Randomize the button pressers. I think it will cool down now for 10 minutes and then I will bring it back. What a shame here. Still switching up. Hey, don't bring it up again, huh? I mean, imagine this is all recorded. It would have been nice if it dies, you know, 10 minutes ago, but now I wanted to show you the summary on the slides. It's coming back. It should come back. So you got the idea. Yeah? You compute then the low frequency polynomial surface fitting, and then you reduce this original signal by the function you fit it in. And by the way, you can also apply this. It will not change if I press it again 500 times. Ah. Okay. So, and this is the more complicated version. Yeah, I mean, we always try to describe things as general as possible. With these polynomials here, using x squared and xy and all these bases here, everything can be explained properly. But of course, you can also use different bases for the polynomial. And then you have to estimate the parameters of these polynomials by a least square estimator. You minimize this error. Usually we use the squared distance here, and you get closed form estimates for the UKLs, and these can be plugged in, and then you get a bias field representation, and then you just correct the original image for that. And you can also use this for your images you do with your iPad or your smartphone. If you have an inhomogeneous illumination where your flash was coming from one side and one part of the image is brighter and the other one is darker, you can fit in, for instance, a 2D surface in your image and then correct for the surface such that the final image is normalized, that the surface is parallel to the XY plane, for instance. So you can correct images with inhomogeneous illumination. Before I go into the statistical part, I won't start it here. I'll show to you applications where we did that. For instance, here again, a fundus image. That's the, again, the retina that you see, and you also see here dark parts and brighter parts. Yeah, and here you can apply illumination normalization. These are the standard methods we have developed for MR imaging, and these are applied to color images acquired in this context. Or here you see also a very dark fundus gray level image. We do a bias correction and get an homogeneous illumination in this image. Or where we also apply it and where it's not so obvious at the beginning, for ultrasound images. For instance, if you use an ultrasound probe and you capture ultrasound images, you know the deeper the ultrasound waves go into the tissue, the weaker the signal will be. So ultrasound images usually look bright in the first image rows, and it's getting darker and darker and darker the deeper you go into the human body. And this is also a bias field. And this has to be corrected. For instance, here you see this dark area here, and here with a bias field correction, we brighten it up. Yeah. Once we wrote a paper on ultrasound imaging and we explained how we done the image intensity normalization, and then one reviewer told us, well, these things are implemented in the scanner anyways, so this should not show up in the final scan. That's right. All the ultrasound devices, they have a built-in inhomogeneity correction method, but still the images that fall out of these scanners are not that brilliant. So with some post-processing methods, you can also improve the image quality in terms of contrast resolution. Yeah? So again, another example where these pre-processing techniques we have developed for a certain type of scanner is easily transformed into different application fields, like the idea with the defect pixels. Just to remind you, we have used this also for eliminating specular reflections in endoscopic imaging, and I have also shown to you an example where we sandpapered the vessel structure in fundus images to decrease the variation of fundus images from individuum to individuum. So also a very nice application. Okay, see you on Thursday. I think we should quit here. Thank you.